Well, it's a real honor and a pleasure to be with you tonight. I don't do a lot of speaking, but this invitation came to me at a weak moment. And it just so happened that I was just finishing a long time of working on a novel. And it's a real relief to turn to something like a speech and work on something completely different. Oh, one more thing I have to do here. I'm a writer by trade, and you'll notice that I'm wearing the badge of my profession tonight, a stethoscope. This isn't just any stethoscope. It's a gold stethoscope that I won as an award for writing. In fact, this is something I share in common with last year's speaker, David Richardson. Is he here tonight?
He's not.
No. And with one other physician I know who's here, David Chapman. The three of us are proud winners of the Gold Stethoscope Award given by the sadly now defunct Journal of Medical Humor, Stitches, for the best anecdote of the month. So, of course, I want to begin by sharing my award-winning anecdote with you. Now, my wife Karen and I have an ongoing debate over who actually won this gold stethoscope. Did she win it for supplying the anecdote? Or did I win it for the masterly way that I wrote it? In all honesty, I have to admit that Karen may have the edge, because she not only supplied the story, but she wrote the punchline. So I'll let you judge. Here it is. When I moved my practice from the prairies to a small town at the southern end of the Fraser Canyon, it wasn't just the geography that changed from horizontal to vertical. I also noted a corresponding shift in local injuries. One night, a 16-year-old boy was brought in by a friend who reported that he'd had an accident on the Fraser Canyon Highway. A motor vehicle accident, was it? Well, not exactly, said the friend sheepishly. It seemed that his comrade had needed to stop to relieve himself by the side of the road, and, losing his footing in the darkness, had ended up sitting in a cold mountain stream 20 feet below. Luckily, the boy's injuries were not serious. Apparently, the etiology of his condition, excessive alcohol consumption, had also cushioned his fall. About a month later, I learned that this regional type of accident was by no means specific, either to darkness or to drunks. For the next victim was a middle-aged man, perfectly sober, who in broad daylight had skidded 30 feet down the canyon with his zipper open. When the x-ray revealed a broken heel, I suggested that he might have been safer had he been drinking. Two of these cases within a month convinced me that this particular affliction of Fraser Canyon travelers deserved a scientific name. I call it urinary precipitatitis. The moral? Look before you leak. Four little golden words, look before you leak. I guess Karen wins, but I'm still keeping the stethoscope. I think the truth is that she and I won this award together. It's like 28 years ago, when we spent the first year of our marriage studying theology in Vancouver. Very quickly, we discovered that there were more interesting things for newlyweds to do than to read a bunch of dusty old books. By meeting all the academic requirements, we could have earned a diploma, but we ended up auditing about half of our courses, and we like to say now that we earned the diploma between us. We also like to say, in moments of foolishness, that we're so closely united that it's almost as if we share one brain. In case you missed that, it implies that we're a pair of half-wits. Actually, a writer and a doctor are a very good combination. She lives stories, and I write them. I don't mean that normally I write the stories that flow unceasingly from her medical practice. No, I write my own stories. But a love of stories does make for a very interesting common ground between us. She loves to read the stories that I write, and she loves to flog my books in the hospital. And I love to hear the stories that she tells me at the end of her day. Naturally, she doesn't mention any names. And if you believe that, you're very gullible indeed. While information goes into the chart, stories are the way she really organizes her day's work in her mind. Stories are, after all, how life happens. Life is not just a flow of data, it's a flow of events and encounters that are emotionally charged, negatively or positively. In other words, that are always moving either toward complication or resolution. Just think about how many stories you as doctors hear in the course of a day. I suppose there are some physicians who see only the facts of a case, but don't most of you experience meaning in your work to the extent that you feel involved in your patient's stories? Isn't that, along with money, what keeps you going back to the office day after day? With those in your care, you want to know, what's going to happen next? How will this turn out? Will this patient emerge from their depression? Will this cancer be cured? Will I have something to do with the cure? Will I make the right diagnosis and provide the right treatment? Does what I do matter to the story? You see, both you and your patient are involved in an ongoing narrative with all the characteristics of a page-turning novel. Tension, conflict, humor, depth of character, triumph, defeat, death. And along the way, you find precisely what you look for in a good book, not just entertainment, but insight into the mystery of life. Is that perhaps why you went into the medical profession in the first place? To get as close to the mystery of life, real life, as you could? To really live and to give life to others? Has it worked for you? Or do you sometimes feel trapped in something that has less to do with life than with death? Not just physical death, but soul death. Is the sacrifice you've made to the god of medicine worth it? As a writer, I have to confess that sometimes alone in a room with nothing but a keyboard and a screen, trying to make something up, or going over and over something I've already made up, and trying obsessively to get every word to be the right word in the right place, and to do it all with a crushing deadline hanging over my head. Sometimes this process feels more like death than like life. But that's part of the story too. Without death, there is no life. Unless the work I do costs me everything, there's no possibility of it giving life. To me or to anyone else. I don't mean we need to be workaholics, sacrificing our families or our happiness. But when we go to work, the cost is very high. Just as in a great story, life and death hang in the balance. Is this why many physicians have been writers? Chekhov, the great Russian playwright and story writer, practiced medicine throughout most of his literary career. "Medicine is my lawful wife," he said, "and literature is my mistress." Or many of you will know Vincent Lamb, the recent Giller Prize winner, who also somehow manages to balance both careers. "I always thought writing and medicine were different," he says, "until I began to write about medicine." He feels that physicians only excel by managing stories. By which he means not only listening well, but communicating well the course of healing. A friend of mine who did community health in Africa discovered that all his teaching about the importance of personal hygiene had little effect. But when he told a story about the journey of the germ, then people understood and began to wash their hands. A doctor I know once prescribed fiction to a dying patient. The man was complaining that, although he had numerous visitors, none of them would look him in the eye and talk about what was really going on. "It's so lonely," he said. The physician wrote on a prescription pad the title of Tolstoy's wonderful story, The Death of Ivan Ilyich. After reading it, the man thanked him profusely and said, "Finally, I feel understood." The relationship between medicine and stories goes back to the primitive shaman, who healed not only through herbs and magic, but through storytelling. Often a poet, the shaman was the keeper of stories and legends for his tribe. As Jerome Gropman puts it in his book, How Doctors Think, while modern medicine is aided by a dazzling array of technologies, language is still the bedrock of clinical practice. Recently, I heard an interview with doctor and writer Balfour Mount, the physician who established North America's first integrated hospice and who actually coined the term palliative care. Right now, Dr. Mount is himself fighting his third battle with cancer, this time a form that has paralyzed his vocal cords. It was amazing to hear him talk at all, as he was interviewed by the CBC's Michael Enright. Enright tried to pin him down on the topic of euthanasia, but Dr. Mount, rather than engaging in debate, answered in the form of stories. He told one about a patient named Chip, who was an Olympic skier, and a successful businessman with a lovable, charismatic personality. One of those people who's voted most likely to succeed and then does. At the age of 30, Chip was diagnosed with advanced testicular cancer. After radical surgery and chemotherapy, he appeared to be healed. But a year later, the cancer returned, and this world-class athlete who'd had a powerful physique became as wasted as a victim of Auschwitz. 2 days before he died, Balfour Mount was sitting at his bedside when Chip said, "You know, this past year has been the best year of my life." Balfour was shocked. "This year of ferocious, mortal illness, the best year of that life?" He asked him what he meant, and Chip said, "I've had a wonderful life, but I've always been directed outward. In this last year, I've been turned inwards. I've had the chance to journey within, and it's been the most exciting journey of all." The day after that, he married his fiancée, and the next day he died. Some years ago, I attended a church where the pastor had a secret. One day over coffee, he told me his secret. I don't know why he told me, but he did. He said that once a week on his day off, he went to Vancouver to visit with AIDS patients at St. Paul's Hospital. He didn't go there to preach or even to talk. No, he just sat and listened to people's stories. I'll never forget him leaning close to me to whisper, "The really great thing about this, Mike, is that nobody knows I do it." His wife knew, but no one else in the church knew. Why? Because this pastor wanted one thing in his life that he knew he wasn't doing for points. He didn't do it to be admired. He didn't even do it primarily to serve those he visited. He did it for himself, because listening to the dying tell their life stories helped him to journey within. Reminds me of the poem by Robert Browning. I walked a mile with pleasure, and she chatted all the way, but left me none the wiser for what she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and never a word said she, but oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. Another friend of mine, a doctor and a writer, has devoted a large part of his practice to palliative care. Like my pastor friend, he's done a lot of listening. In fact, he says he's often surprised at how little he has to say to the dying. I won't mention his name because of what I'm about to tell you. A brilliant man, he happened to be severely challenged when it came to multiple choice exams. After a long struggle just to be accepted into medicine, 3 times he failed the LMCC exam before finally he passed. Passionate to be a physician, those were dark years for him. In retrospect, massive failure at the beginning of his career prepared him in the end to care for people facing the final greatest failure of all. Do you know why God made people? It's because he loves stories. There's a true story about a man who was sent to the electric chair in Chicago. As they strapped him down and put the hood over his head, his last words were, "This will certainly teach me a lesson." Doesn't a line like that make you proud to be human? Listen to another story, an old Hasidic parable. When the great rabbi, the Baal Shem Tov, saw misfortune threatening his people, it was his custom to go into a certain part of the forest to meditate. There he would light a fire, say a special prayer, and the miracle would be accomplished and the misfortune averted. Later, when his disciple, the Maggid of Mezrich, had occasion to intercede with heaven, he would light a fire and say, "Master of the universe, listen. I do not know the place in the forest, but I am still able to say the prayer." And again, the miracle would be accomplished. Still later, it fell to Rabbi Moshe Leib of Sassov to overcome misfortune. Sitting in his armchair, his head in his hands, he spoke to God. "I cannot find the place in the forest, and I am unable to light the fire. I do not even know the prayer. All I can do is to tell the story, and this must be sufficient." And it was. I've titled this talk, Storytelling, The Ointment of the Healer. This phrase comes from BC artist Roy Vickers, whose print entitled South Chesterman is displayed on the easel over there. I don't know if you can see it, but he's put the words I quoted as a caption. Karen and I feel very close to this place because we go to Chesterman Beach near Tofino for a week or so every summer. And always a highlight is our visit to Roy Vickers' gallery. It's a wonderful place. One day, Roy was out on his boat near Tofino when he saw an eagle about 200 feet overhead. He called to it, and the eagle's head turned as if to acknowledge him. A moment later, he noticed something white fluttering towards him, an eagle feather. He reached up to catch it, but missed, and the feather landed right on his chest. In local First Nations culture, the one who holds an eagle feather has the right to speak. In a council meeting, the feather is passed from person to person, and whoever holds it is respectfully listened to. When a white feather floated out of the blue, and landed on Roy Vickers' chest. He knew he was being given the right to speak. From that point on, as well as being an internationally acclaimed artist, he began to pursue a call to storytelling. You can hear him in March in Tofino this year, telling stories in his gallery. I heard my own call to storytelling about 7 years ago when I set out to write my first novel. For 20 years, I'd written nonfiction books, mostly about relationships. My first book on the topic of marriage had done so well that it encouraged me to keep on mining that vein. However, when I'd first dreamed of becoming a writer about age 11, I assumed I would write stories. Fiction is what I read, and I wanted to follow in the footsteps of my heroes. Jules Verne, John Steinbeck, and later Hemingway and Fitzgerald. Along the way, I did publish a couple of books of short stories, but they didn't sell. And so the years passed, and the decades, and I didn't pursue my deepest dream. I let it die. At the age of 50, I knew it was now or never. I had to write a novel. I had an idea that was tugging at me, and I thought I could do it. A novel is just a long story, isn't it? How hard could it be? Like most people, I was blissfully ignorant of the fact that it can take a minimum of 10 years to learn to write a novel. Very soon into the process, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. After 3 chapters, I was in way over my head and swimming like mad. For a novel, I learned, will test to the absolute limits a writer's weaknesses. There are so many balls to keep in the air, plot, character, dialogue, on and on. A weakness at any one point threatens the credibility of the whole story. My great weakness, I soon realized, was plot. How to keep a story moving over the long haul of 300 or 400 pages. For the first time in my writing life, the blank page terrified me. I had the beginning of my story and a few episodes further on and the glimmer of an ending. But how to get there? What was going to happen next? I cannot exaggerate the sheer panic that this created in me. I think what was happening was that I was having to change not just my writing, but my mind, my whole attitude to life, from being fact or reason-based to being story-based. Talk about taking a journey within. But I believe our greatest gifts lie deepest within and are consequently hardest to uncover. 6 months or a year into this journey, having committed myself wholeheartedly to my novel and feeling I had to pull it off in order to rescue the lost, drifting wreckage of my dreams, and being completely stuck, well, the stakes were very high. As doctors, I'm sure you know what it's like to be at the very extremity of your competence, with people looking on. So I read books about novel writing, I took courses, I racked my brains. Time after time, I ran into an absolute brick wall. Time after time, I thought I had lost my story, that it would never come together, that there was no way to solve this or that crisis in my plot. Even when I finally finished a first draft, then the real problems began. Creating a whole world in fiction is a little like the time my friend Robert Held, the Vancouver glassblower, was commissioned by the Governor General to create a perfectly matching set of 24 hand-blown goblets for Rideau Hall. I'll let you imagine how many goblets he had to throw away in order to finally achieve a perfect set. At least he knew what I was doing, what he was doing, and just had to do it. I was totally lost. Well, somehow I got through it, and just over a year ago, I published my first novel, The Blue Umbrella. It's a children's fantasy, but of course, a good children's story is for adults too. As Elaine told you, it's set right here in Murrayville at the Five Corners, where the familiar landmark of Porter's Store becomes the scene of mystery and magic. I had my book launch there, except instead of calling it a book launch, I called it a grand opening. I hope no one here is superstitious about opening an umbrella indoors. Because Gandalf has his staff, Luke Skywalker has his lightsaber, Harry Potter has his wand, and my character, Sky Porter, has his blue umbrella. I love that spring-loaded action. It makes me feel like James Bond. I wish I could read to you the central scene in my novel, but it would ruin the story. Yet of all that I've published in 10 books over a quarter of a century, there's one chapter in The Blue Umbrella that is my own favorite. So I guess it was worth the effort. And this June we'll see the publication of the second novel in the series called The Violet Flash. What have I learned as I've wrestled with my soul to produce these two books? I've learned to trust the story. I've learned that a story has a life of its own, a life that I need not, indeed cannot, manufacture, but can only discover. To the extent that my own journey of discovery is fresh and wide-eyed and innocent and truly exciting, it will be so for my readers. While I cannot claim to have learned this perfectly, over the two books, I've grown immensely. The second novel was no easier to write, but I wasn't nearly so panicked. I faced the difficulties with relative composure. And as I began to relax about writing a novel, I began to relax more in my own life. I learned to trust, not just my fictional story, but the story that I myself am living as it unfolds from day to day. This is what stories can give us, a sense of the largeness of life, the capacity of life to hold safely all of our pain, fear, doubt, and struggle, as well as love and joy and laughter. In a story, it all belongs. All has a meaningful place, as opposed to our minds, which so often balk at the immensity of life, particularly the immensity of suffering. By taking off all the limits, stories set us free, give us permission to be more than we think we are. As Canadian novelist Carol Shields wrote, in creative writing courses, one of the first things you learn is to keep your characters consistent. This is bad advice, because human beings are not consistent. In fact, the very moments that are most interesting are the moments in which people act inconsistently, out of character, when they suddenly leap up and become larger than life. Or, I would argue, when they fade away and become frighteningly small. Tonight I'm recording this message because I wanted my father to hear it. For years he's been in a care home in Ontario, profoundly debilitated, a victim of Alzheimer's. His 90th birthday is in February. Happy birthday, Dad. I'm saying it now because he won't be here for it. Just this week, he took a turn for the worse, and right now, he's very close to death. Since I haven't been able to visit him often, I make CDs for him, just 20 minutes or so of me talking about what's going on in my life and letting him know I love him. My sister takes the latest CD when she visits him, and together they listen to it. She asks him, "Dad, do you want to listen to Mike's CD?" And he always says yes. Does he know who I am? At some level, yes, I believe so. But let me share with you another story, this one told by a nurse in a hospital emergency department. It was a busy morning, about 8:30, when an elderly gentleman in his 80s arrived to have stitches removed from his thumb. He said he was in a hurry as he had an appointment at 9 o'clock. I took his vital signs and offered him a seat, knowing it would be over an hour before someone would be able to see him. I noticed him looking at his watch and decided, since I was not busy, I would evaluate his wound. On exam, it was well healed, so I talked to one of the doctors and then got the needed supplies to remove his sutures and redress the wound. While doing so, I asked him if he had another doctor's appointment this morning, as he was in such a hurry. He told me no, but that he needed to go to the nursing home to have breakfast with his wife. I inquired as to her health, and he said she had been there for a while and was a victim of Alzheimer's. I asked if she would be upset if he was a bit late. He replied that she no longer knew who he was, that she had not recognized him in 5 years. Surprised, I asked, "And you still go every morning, even though she doesn't know who you are?" He smiled as he patted my hand and said, "She doesn't know me, but I know who she is." True love is an acceptance of all that is, has been, will be, and will not be. God made people because he loves stories. Do you? Do you love your story? The one you're living with all its ups and downs? Can you love it if for no other reason than just because it's yours? Do you have confidence that regardless of sickness, death, or all the chances and changes of life, your story will turn out well? If not, are you really listening to your story? Can we change our mind from being fact-based to being story-based? For Christmas, I gave my daughter a binary clock. I can't read it, but she can. She picked it up right away. Which just goes to show that there are 10 kinds of people in the world. Those who understand binary and those who don't. When it comes to stories, there are 10 kinds of people in the world. Those who understand that life is a story, and those who don't. For those who do understand and trust the story, despite the chaos, they know that their life is going somewhere, that no matter what happens, they can enjoy the ride in the deepest sense of enjoy, as you enjoy a good novel. Do you know there are two ways to ride a roller coaster? Or? And there are two ways to meet another person. Or? Today, no matter what you're facing, accept the invitation to trust your story and journey within. Thank you.